Going back to 1956 in Newport with the Duke Ellington Orchestra and that historical moment here on WNTI 91.9 FM and online at WNTI.org. Jack Devaney with you here for the Bluesology Just Jazz edition, along with Mr. Bob Bernotis and our very, very esteemed guest, Monsignor John Sanders, who was there that night in Newport and going back over a half a decade ago, or half a century ago, excuse me, and taking us back through all those beautiful memories of how that was such a special night for yourself and the Ellington Orchestra right there, Monsignor.
Yes, it was, Jack. It was a special night. We had no idea this was going to happen. It was just spontaneous. And that's the way it is with jazz, too, isn't it? Just very spontaneous. And people just kind of fall in line, and they get the feeling, and everyone joins together. And I think we were all quite taken back by it.
And things really did change, I guess, Bob. We were chit-chatting with Monsignor during the song for the orchestra. There was almost a new direction, a rebirth, dare I say.
Well, when the recording came out, it was a huge seller. It was really the biggest selling album that Duke Ellington had. And after that, there were, you know, no more Aquacade shows. There were more festivals and big bookings and TV specials and tours of Europe. It really, Duke Ellington used to like to joke that he was born in 1956 at the Newport Jazz Festival. And in a way, he was reborn there. The band really got a kind of a second wind, in a sense. Well, then from that point until Duke Ellington's death and afterwards, the Duke Ellington Orchestra has remained in the forefront of jazz.
Hmm. Bob, there were a whole bunch of things that you wanted to actually bring up.
And one of the recordings I wanted to bring up is one that I'm very fond of, and I think that everybody who listens to jazz and loves jazz is also very fond of. I'm talking about the recording that Ella Fitzgerald did called the Duke Ellington Songbook that featured the Duke Ellington Orchestra on many of the tracks. And there was one tune in particular that featured you in a solo role, which was a little different because you were a great role player and team player. But here on Lost in Meditation, you got a chance to come out front and play not just in front of the orchestra, but behind Ella's singing. That must have been a wonderful time for you.
Oh, yes, it was. I was delighted to have that opportunity to play one of the Juan Tizol compositions on the viol trombone on an Ella Fitzgerald date. I was so very grateful for that opportunity. And I think Billy Strayhorn and Duke wanted Ella to have the, you know, the standard songs in the album, but they wanted to redo it a little bit, but not to destroy the original. So I felt a responsibility to try to carry through.
And it's a lovely vehicle. Of course, she does Don't Get Around Much Anymore and all the famous songs, but this is one that's a little bit lesser known. And
it is.
I think it's really one of the best tracks from that album. I believe it was originally a multi-disc LP, and I'm not sure how many there were, maybe three or four discs in the original package, you know, in the LP days. And even now it's, I think, three CDs. And just a lovely, lovely performance. I know we just heard some music, but why don't we hear some again?
I think we could. Monsignor, if we would, we'll go back to yourself and Duke and Ella.
From 1957, Lost in Meditation. Thank you. One of the loveliest recordings in the Duke Ellington discography and the Ella Fitzgerald discography, Lost in Meditation from the 1957 Duke Ellington songbook. And I know Jack will agree that, you know, we can't be sitting in the same room with the great Duke Ellington or the great Ella Fitzgerald or the great Ray Nance, who is heard on trumpet, but it's just a pleasure to be sitting in the same room with John Sanders, who was featured on the Val trombone on that track, playing some very pretty melody statements and the obbligato behind Ella Fitzgerald's vocal.
You know, Monsignor, we were talking about, during the song, how there's been so many great touring aspects to what you've done and so many great recording aspects. But tell us for a moment about the camaraderie. When you weren't performing or you weren't in the studio or writing or, you know, transposing, that kind of stuff. Tell us about the day in, day outs, the meals, the good times, maybe the occasional music or movie together, maybe, or the occasional, something to drink. Tell us about those moments or getting to be with Ella and those friendships. Tell us about some of those aspects you remember.
Well, there are many fond memories, Jack, many fond memories. In fact, speaking of that recording day, my sister, Angela, wanted to meet Ella Fitzgerald, and so she accompanied me to the studio that for those recordings, at least one session, and she sat in the back, and some of the wives of the musicians were there, and when I had an opportunity, I introduced Angela to Ella, and she was very gracious. Just wonderful. And Mercer Ellington was there, and I remember when we left the studio, Mercer took Angela and myself. We went to a little coffee bar and had a snack together before we parted ways. But that was a very pleasant memory. And I must say, yes, there were times when I do remember when we're not on the bandstand or traveling, we're just together with one another. There were wonderful opportunities. On the bus, we would all had our own seat for the most part, you know? And we would pull out of a place, and it would be late at night. Everyone's hungry. They can't wait to get something to eat. And Shorty Baker, when the bus is rolling down the highway and it's dark, he says, "Well, let me get this fried chicken down here and get into it." And all of a sudden, a little stirring. He liked to edge on everybody. You know, he had something special that they didn't have. And he'd make believe he's going to reach up to the overhead and bring down a box of chicken and some goodies. Shorty Baker had a great sense of humor. He was just absolutely funny.
Would Duke
make you laugh, even on a bandstand when you didn't want to laugh.
would Duke be by himself a lot and kind of in his own, I don't want to say his own world, but maybe for lack of a better term, I will. You know, was his focus just so entrenched in the music? Would you guys kind of just the band fade off and Duke would always kind of be in his own space? Was that the case?
Yes. Well, on the bus, Duke sat right up in front. He was with us. But with nothing unusual, going down the highway in the middle of the night, and his light would go on, and he'd reach up And I knew what he was doing. He got some manuscript, and he'd be hunched over the light on his front seat there writing. It was nothing for him to do that. And you can bet your life was a new piece, you know, blossoming. And when we got to a hotel, like I remember in Chicago, everyone went in their own direction. You know, it wasn't unusual to stay at the Sherman Hotel. I like to stay downtown so that during the day I can walk around and maybe shop a little bit, maybe catch a movie, I don't know. But very seldom did I have that much time because Duke kept me busy. And he stayed at the Sherman, and I did. And he would often call me, John, are you busy, you know? Mm-hmm. Can you come over? Are you hungry? And I say, oh, yeah, I'm getting hungry. Why don't you come over and we'll have something? But I knew what was going on.
You're going to have to start copying.
Duke was working on a score, and he wants me to copy something. But he was very gracious. He had a nice way of going about it. But
so I remember, you actually, before, I'm going to interrupt, you actually had a very unique experience compared to the rest of the guys in the band, where you'd end up getting more one-on-one time with Duke than the guys, just by this default of this talent you had for the copying.
Well, that's true, Jack. Yes, we were always, you know, going over score. I'd get it, and I'd go back to his room. Duke, now in this part here, did you intend for this to happen, or am I right here or there? And he'd look at it and said, You didn't understand that? He'd make you feel like, well, it's clear, isn't it? And he knew very well it wasn't.
Sure, sure.
But he was very kind, and he appreciated what you could do. And it was a lot of back and forth. And I'd be up all kind of hours, you know. I'd catch a few winks on the bus.
And would Duke pretty, was it constant work? Is it fair to say that? Or would he give himself a little bit of time to catch his breath?
Well, Duke, he was constantly writing. But when he was in a hotel room, he would relax, you know. And he loved just to call for room service, you know, have things brought up. And you have to run around and order things. Hmm. But I remember one morning we came into the Sherman Hotel. We checked in. I got to my room. I said, I think I'll go down to the coffee shop, you know. We've been traveling all night. So I walked in the coffee shop. Guess who came in with? Duke Ellington came in with the manager. And so I was sitting at the coffee stand, you know, perched on a stool. And Duke came in, you know, he didn't look for the maitre d' to show him to a table in the coffee room itself. He just came over and sat on a stool with the manager and to join me. Hmm. The waitress came out, and he just said, let's have something, and we ordered. And so, what are you going to have, John? I said, I think I'll have some oatmeal. He said, okay. And he ordered his breakfast. The manager, Al Sully, ordered. And so he said, well, what you going to have with it? I said, well, I'll have a little milk and sugar. He says, no, John, you got to have ice cream on that oatmeal. I said, Duke, it's morning, it's breakfast, ice cream? He said, yes. He kept talking, and I said, you try it. So I said, I looked at the waitress and said, okay, vanilla ice cream on the top.
The boss wants me to have ice cream. You got it.
So she brought it out, and I began to eat it, and I said, oh, my gosh, it's delicious.
Oh, yeah.
And he smiled, you know.
The gourmand of Duke Ellington.
So there
Ellington,
we were
yeah.
sitting in the coffee shop after all night ride, and he had what he wanted, and I had oatmeal with ice cream for the first time in my life, and I never forgot it.
That's great.
But Duke was very, very relaxed. Very, he was very kind to everyone he met in our hotel. Mm. He made a waitress feel like a queen. Mm. He would just never take anyone for granted. Mm-hmm. When she served us, it was like, you know, that was fine. Thank you. Made her feel good.
It was an honor to be served by her, not to be serving Duke
That's
Ellington,
right?
Yeah.
He was very, very relaxed and low-key, never looked for a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Just enjoyed being, you know, I'm going to have a little rest here and maybe I have a chance to write some music. Mm. And
well, after 5.5, obviously, wonderful years on the road with Duke Ellington, why did you finally decide to leave the band in 1959?
Well, Bob, that's a good question. You know, on the road, I began to think more about the priesthood. And this happened, it got started way back when I was in the Navy. The Navy chaplain said to me, when we were getting ready for discharge, he said, John, you know, there's a seminary in Louisiana, I think would be just wonderful for you, you know, to study for the priesthood. And I was quite taken back by that.
Direct of a statement.
Yeah, just, because we hadn't talked about that. Although, Father Joseph Fulton, the one I'm speaking of, he was also a chaplain to a seminary in Oakland, as well as a chaplain to the pre-flight Navy base in Oakland. And he invited me one time for a weekend just to come and meet some of the seminarians. Was no talk of a vocation or priesthood. He said, "Would you like to spend a weekend?" I said, "Yes, I wouldn't mind, Father." So I did that. I spent the weekend. I was a guest. And I tell you, it was a peaceful weekend. I never forget it. But not one of them said to me, "Are you going to be a priest?" No. I was just a guest. I never forgot the impression I got. These young men were studying for the priesthood. And I went back to the base. I felt very good about that. But I told Father Fulton I wanted to go to New York, back with the family, and I wanted to go to Juilliard. And he understood that. He understood. But he said, "Let's keep in touch." So that was the beginning, Bob, of the stirring of priesthood thoughts. In 1956, after Newport, we're traveling out west, I met a priest in Salt Lake City, Father William McDougall, who had been a reporter in the specific theater of war.
Mm-hmm.
He had been torpedoed. He ended up in the Japanese prison camp. He came out of the war, and he became a priest, and he was in Salt Lake City.
Hmm.
And I just accidentally met him on a Saturday at his church. I went up there. I thought maybe, okay, it's Saturday. I think I'll go to confession and get ready for Sunday. But he told me, he asked me, "What are you doing with your life?" I said, I'm with an orchestra. I'm a musician. He said, "But what are you doing ultimately with your life? What state of life are you thinking of? Single life, married life, religious, priesthood?" I said, "Gee, Father, I haven't really thought through on that yet. I'm single now. I'm really not attached to anyone." So he said, "There's a course that the Catholic University of Ottawa puts out, a correspondence course on vocations to the four states in life." He said, "Why don't you get in touch with them and begin to read about them, think about them?" I said, "All right, I will." And I did.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow I followed through, and I began to get courses on these states of life. And the priesthood kind of loomed out at me.
Mm.
I thought of Father Fulton again. And so I began to read the material. Then I met Father Norman O'Connor in Boston. He was a chaplain at Boston University.
And he had the nickname, if I may, of the Jazz
the
Priest.
The Jazz Priest.
So here we are. I guess we're talking summer 19, what are we, when you kind of give your notice to Duke for the road?
1959.
59. So
yes,
here we are. I mean, we're talking a good five solid years, as Bob mentioned, five and a half solid years on the road at this point. Tell us about that last summer. And Bob, if I may, tell us about how you broke the news to the boss.
That's what I'd like to hear. Yeah.
Yes.
How did Duke react when you told him, "Duke, not only am I going to leave your orchestra, but I'm considering the priesthood"?
Well,
yeah.
And maybe even give the story of where and when. Yeah.
All right. Then I'll do my best here. Well, actually, that last year and that summer, I decided I would have to, after reading the material and be attracted to the priesthood in that.
Something was stirring, obviously.
I knew that. Yeah. Something was stirring, and I knew I had to go home. That's the first thing.
So not necessarily I got to go to the seminary,
right,
it's I got to go home. Yeah,
I want to go home, and I want to think all this through. It made such an impression on me. I said, if I stay, I'll never do it. Too busy a life. And so I was thinking more of, I should go back home, be with the family, and maybe go to night school. I had a high school diploma and a Juilliard diploma, but I didn't have an academic background. So I said, maybe it's time for me to think about getting some college education, if I should ever follow through on the vocation to the priesthood. So I went to Duke Sherman Hotel. And I called him on his room. I said, "Duke, can I come over? I want to see you."
Oh, so this happened in Chicago.
In Chicago.
Right,
at the Sherman Hotel
that
summer.
The city of the infamous ice cream and oatmeal incident. Then.
Yes, that's right. We're back at the Sherman. And I went over to Duke's room, and he was just getting ready for the evening dinner and then the engagement, you know, the Blue Note, and he was receiving me so gracious, like he always does. But I said, "Duke, there's something I have to tell you." And I told him about my plans. I really want to go home. I want to leave the orchestra. But this is well in advance of the actual leaving. I think it might have been before, not just the summer, that spring.
So you gave many months notice.
Going, yeah. I didn't want to just say, "Well, Duke, next week I'm going home," or 2 weeks. No. I knew he had to get on the phone, talk to Mercer, try to find a replacement. That was very paramount in my thinking. Don't ever leave without giving him a chance to make some adjustment. So I explained it to him, and I tell you, it was difficult. But Duke listened very carefully, quietly, and he said, "John, all right." He says, "But make your experience work for you when you go home. In other words, all you've learned about everything, make it work for you." And only way I can describe it, Jack and Bob, was like, you felt like a young man talking to his father, and you wanted to leave home, and you wanted to go out on your own. He listened so gently, so kindly, and it was just wonderful. Mm. And so he knew, and then the word began to spread through the band. But I had to tell him first so he would know. And his response was very positive and very encouraging.
How did your colleagues in the band react when they found out what your plans were?
Well, they weren't for it. You know, I could tell they were a little disappointed, maybe. They didn't think I was going to leave, and I felt badly about that. Yeah. They felt disappointed.
You shared with me also, if I may, a while ago, that whole last summer when he would conduct the orchestra, wouldn't he look over at you, shake his head, and like, "I can't believe you're leaving, John."
Yes, he did. Oh. Whole time on the bandstand, you know, as he turned around, and he would say, "No, John, no, you can't go. No, you're not going." And the guys knew what was happening, but they, at the same time, they knew I had to do this, and they were very, very encouraging too. But at first, they were surprised, you know. They thought I would, you know. And, you know, had this not happened, I probably would have remained with the band as long as Duke would have me.
Now, even though you left the band in 1959, you still maintained a relationship with Duke Ellington for a number of years afterwards. You were still were you still working for him in some capacity?
Yes. Yeah. We kept a nice, close relationship. Whenever I could, I'd visit the band wherever they were playing. When I was in the seminary, I'd come home and look them up and find out where they are. But, yeah, we kept up the relationship. In fact, Duke had called me several times if I could help out. Once he called me, they were going to Washington to do a concert, and he needed a trombone. One of the players had gone home for some reason, and I got a last-minute call, and I said, "Well, Duke, you know, I haven't been playing." He said, "Don't worry, you'll be all right, you know, don't worry." And this was so immediate, I had to catch a shuttle flight to Washington to meet the band there to play at the White House, and Duke wanted to play Black, Brown, and Beige. So that meant he wanted the Val trombone there for come Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you again, I had to go home and do some wood chopping to get ready. But I went down to Washington and played this and came back with them on the bus. It was wonderful. And then he called me again. He had a date at Westbury, Long Island, with Tony Bennett, and he needed a trombonist, so I was able to fill in that. And then the recording for Billy Strayhorn, Butter Jackson called me. I was working in a music store, Sherman's, downtown, for the summer in between seminary. And Butter said, "John, Duke would like you to come down. We're doing Billy Strayhorn, and he wants you to play Rain Check and play also Rock Skipping at the Blue Note." That was also Billy Strayhorn featuring the trombones.
Mm-hmm.
Lawrence Brown was in the orchestra, and Buster Cooper. I said, "Butter, I can't. I haven't been playing." Oh, he said, "Oh, John, you can. Go home tonight and practice. Yeah. Just get your instrument out and just warm up. I said, "Butter." He said, "No, John, Duke wants you, please." So I said, "Okay, I'll do it." I went home that night worrying. But after dinner, I just went down the basement and I began to practice. I went down to the studio, and I tell you what an experience that was to walk in and see Johnny and Harry, Lawrence. And so I did Rain Check and Rock Skipping at the Blue Note, and then that was all I had to play. I think Clark Terry had come in at another time to fill in with someone else. But what a callback that was. I was delighted because I love Rain Check and the other pieces that we played, Rocksgiving. Yeah, so one night Duke called me. I was at the store. He was up in the big hotel on 6th Avenue, 53rd Street. One of the big ones.
Was it the Sheraton or the Hilton?
The Hilton.
The Hilton.
Duke was at the Hilton. Duke would go get a hotel room downtown, leave the apartment up on Sugar Hill, get in a room up in one of the hotels, barricade himself in, and finish the deadline. He was writing ballet music for the American Ballet Theater. He's writing a piece called The River, mm-hmm. composed by Duke, but it had to be orchestrated for a theater orchestra, not just the Ellington Band. A theater orchestra. That meant woodwinds, strings, brass, mm-hmm. percussion. Yeah. He was working, and he said, John, I need you. Can you come over when you finish work? I said, yes, Duke, I'll come over. So I went over there, and he's working up in his room, and I began to copy. And late at night, he says, can you stay? I said, well, I didn't come prepared. He said, can you stay, and we'll have room service for you in the morning. So he shows me what to do, what I'm going to do all that night. He goes home, leaves the hotel, and he had room service, wake me up. They brought me up breakfast, but I stayed up that night. Mm-hmm. I think I got a wink or two before I finished what he had for me, but he had to have it done. Mm-hmm. Then the next day he told me, John, can you take something home with you when you finish? And they need it at the State Theater. Lincoln Center, finished the copying of The River. So I went home and worked at it, and I took the subway back. I delivered it to the stage door. That was it. So those are the times when Duke would call me.
I think, Bob, you might even have some music for us.
Well, I do, actually. Since you mentioned that performance of Rain Check, this is from the classic 1967 album, And His Mother Called Him Bill, one of the great big band albums of all time. And it's a tribute to Billy Strayhorn, who had just recently passed away at a very young age of cancer. He was Duke Ellington's right-hand man, and this is an album of music composed by Billy Strayhorn, including some of his last works. But Rain Check was one that goes back to the early 1940s, and we're going to hear right now John Sanders, featured on the trombone, performing with the Duke Ellington Orchestra, Billy Strayhorn's Rain Check.
Right here on WNTI 91.9 FM, online at WNTI.org for the very special edition of Just Jazz and Bluesology. Thank you. 91.9 FM, WNTI, Jack Devaney with you here, and special guest Bob Bernotis, and really special guest, Monsignor John Sanders. We just heard some music there. Bob, we're kind of winding things down. What was our choice selection again?
That was from 1967, the classic album, And His Mother Called Him Bill. Billy Strayhorn's beautiful Rain Check, a really, really wonderful composition, and it featured in the opening chorus on the valve trombone our guest, John Sanders. I want to ask you now, John, jumping ahead, about the last time that you saw Duke Ellington and what that was like, your final experience with the great master of music.
Well, yes, Bob. As a matter of fact, I was at Blessed Sacrament Church in Bridgeport, and I went over to the Shakespeare Theater in Stratford because Duke was going to play a concert there that night, and we wanted to see him. In fact, we had invited the orchestra to stop by the rectory in Bridgeport before going over there. Mm-hmm. But Mercer Ellington called me and said, John, Duke is not feeling well. We're going straight to the theater, so we won't be stopping by. I said, all right, but we'll come over to hear the concert. And so we did. Two priests, a nun, Sister Mary Kathleen, and I, we went over to hear the concert. At the end of the concert, he left the microphone, thanking everybody for coming, acknowledging the musicians, and then they sat down, and he walked over to the piano, and he sat down, and he played Lotus Blossom, mm-hmm. unaccompanied, and it was a beautiful melody by Billy Strayhorn that I always loved. And then when he finished it, the place was in silence, and he just got up, and he walked off. We went backstage to greet him, and he received us in his dressing room very quietly, very graciously as ever, but we promised Stanley we wouldn't stay long. So I introduced Duke to the priest, the nun. We thanked him, and we left. Mm-hmm. But he was gracious right to the end.
And this was when?
February of 1974, and he passed away that May.
Yeah.
He went into the Columbia Presbyterian Hospital on Upper West Side, Manhattan, and he was there in those last months or weeks. Mm-hmm. But Stanley Dance had called me. He said, please, John, can you come down? And Duke is not doing well. We think we're going to lose him, you know. Yeah. So I said, I'll be there tomorrow morning. But he called back, and he said, John, he's gone. Oh, my heart felt like I've lost everything, you know. Yeah. But I didn't get the chance to go to his bedside. But he was that night on stage and in the dressing room. And someone told me later, Bob and Jack, that, and I didn't hear it, but they said, before Duke left the mic and walked over to the piano, they told me, he said, this is for John.
Very nice, mm-hmm. very nice. And I guess it's been just remarkable to look back that there was friendship throughout the whole time. There was camaraderie. There was creativity. And even though, I guess, at a certain point, your paths took a little bit of different directions, as you know, that that bond was still there up until the end, really.
Yes.
And I think Bob had something very special he wanted to share.
Yes, I do. We've been listening to the music of Duke Ellington, but I thought right now I'd like to read some of the words of Duke Ellington. This is a brief excerpt from his book, Music is My Mistress, and he's writing about our guest, John Sanders. And Duke writes, John Sanders was always, as musician, man, and ambassador, a major credit to our band, right from the beginning when he joined it in 1954. A valve trombonist, he played solos that were the nearest we ever had to Teasall's originals. He was a brilliant musician and an irreplaceable aid when we were orchestrating en masse, with a devastating deadline at our heels. In addition, he was a gentleman in every sense of the word, in manners, ethics, and appearances. I love John Sanders and think that just about everyone else who knows him loves him for the great human being that he is. He's from a beautiful, gentle, educated family. His total intent is absolute, unadulterated good, and I tried but could not find a better or more fitting word than that. Good. I'd like to thank our guest, Monsignor John Sanders, for joining us here. It's been a real pleasure talking about the music of Duke Ellington and your life and your experiences with him and your life in music.
And I'll say myself, too, Bob, it's always been cool over these last few years. We've had the opportunity here on the WNTI airwaves to bring the world of just jazz and bluesology together.
Absolutely, Jack.
And again, Monsignor Sanders, from myself, thank you for this time and this great education lesson in something that I feel more knowledgeable about now, being with the both of you, for that matter. And I think there was a tune we were going to leave it with here that you had dug up, Bob, by the name of...
The name is Total Jazz, and this is actually an instrumental track from the Duke Ellington songbook by Ella Fitzgerald, but the band played this as a part of a Portrait of Ella Fitzgerald suite. This is the fourth movement, and it features John Sanders, our guest, in a jazz solo on the valve trombone. Also, the musical voices of Clark Terry, Paul Gonsalves, and Jimmy Hamilton can be heard. But listen very closely for two wonderful blues choruses by the one and only John Sanders.
On behalf of Bob again and myself, Monsignor, I hope it was as enjoyable for you as it was for us.
It certainly was, Jack and Bob. What a pleasure to be with you and kind of walk through the years of music, especially with Duke Ellington. I feel so blessed and thankful. Bye now.